Coming to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, the gaming capital of the world, it's episode 63 of Game On with Cody and John.
This is Game On with Cody and John, the uncommon podcast for the common gamer, bringing you the latest and greatest from the world of tabletop gaming, board games, card games, RPGs, and miniatures wargaming, news and discussions on gaming and gamer culture, plus reviews of some of the best games on the market. And now, from the Game On Studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, here are Cody Jones and John Richard.
Well, howdy gamers, it is Game On with Cody and John. I'm Cody.
And I'm John. It's been another great week in the gaming capital of the world. Cody, how you doing?
Doing great. We got our, I think winter is finally gone. I think we hit 80 here in the gaming capital over the weekend, so fantastic.
And nice and rainy, so you're a happy guy.
That's right. I feel like I should be listening to emo music and writing depressing poetry, but I do love the rain.
It's kind of funny how we start every episode off now with the weather report.
Yeah.
I guess everyone must...
People care.
Just care.
Except
about
the one
that
guy who doesn't like anything about Indianapolis.
That's right.
I don't care what the weather is in Indianapolis.
All right. Well, that was kind of wrestler, you know. That sounded kind of like...
Let me tell you something, brother.
All right. What are we talking about on the show today?
Well, we're doing another entry in our popular segment, A Second Look. Where we're taking a look at a little game called Power Grid. It's not very successful. You probably haven't heard of it.
No, it's a little small publisher.
But I haven't played it for many, many years. I don't know when the last time you played it, John, is, but...
Many years, I think, yeah.
But it's one that continues to be on top on BGG or near the top. And, you know, I know there's some of you out there who've never even played it. So we're going to give it a second look and... you know, I've always made a lot of jokes at the expense of Power Grid, so we'll see what it's like in our second look.
Yeah, you know, we always tend to review the super new hotness of games here on the show, and we still love doing that, but you know, we do occasionally want to pick up something that's in the back catalog a bit and bring it out, because we never want to make the assumption that anyone who's listening to this show just would automatically know about a particular game. Right. You know, even something like Settlers of Catan. You know, I don't want to make the assumption that every listener has played that game. So you know, we just want to bring you this game as if you'd never heard of it before, and we'll give you a review on it to tell you how to play it and everything. And I think it's a pretty good one.
That's right. And kind of in the same vein as Power Grid, we like to pimp our games a little bit here, and we're going to be talking about gaming accessories. What accessories, maybe not even game specific, but what accessories do you have or do you need to really get the most out of your games and make them more fun for y'all?
Mm-hmm. But as always, we're going to start off with a rundown, and that starts
now. Well, it's time for the rundown, where we tell you all of the great games we've been playing, as well as other geekery, starting it off with John.
All right, games I've been playing. I've actually had the opportunity to do two, not just one, but two Game On Game Nights, because there were five Tuesdays in March, mm-hmm. and so we did 2 weeks in a row, which is very exciting. Also included Cody for the first time in the Game On Game Night. That was very exciting to have him there.
Thank you.
Did you sign a lot of autographs?
I did. You know, playing Mansions of Madness, people just kept interrupting me and saying,
yeah.
Oh, is that Cody Jones? No, I was uninterrupted.
We did play Mansions of Madness. You might remember from last episode the debacle that was my game that I played, where I got the wrong objective card.
Inexcusable, really, is the word I would use.
I was trying to redeem myself by putting together another game using a different scenario, and played it correctly. All the cards were in the right place, and I played the right objective card, but I did lose.
Yes.
And it was a difficult, it was like the number four, Classroom Curses or something like that. And for some reason, the cards that I chose and the decisions that I made, it was really hard to get monsters on the board.
It really seemed like it. In fact, I kept checking. I'm like, you sure you got the right cards? You sure you got the right cards?
And I'm all paranoid. So I'm like, oh, well, let me check again. Oh, yeah, I got it right. But, yeah, they did a valiant job. It was Cody, Kalen, and Jay playing that one. So that was a fun one. Also played some Seven Wonders, which is
love it.
Always a
I finally
treat.
Got my copy.
Did you really?
From Myriad Games sitting in my closet.
Are you going to get sleeves?
Yes, I am getting sleeves. It's okay. I'm not. I may have mentioned this before. I'm not a sleeve guy, but... I've seen other people's copies of Seven Wonders, and they just seem like they get destroyed. You know, some of them are on fire and have exploded. And
wow,
no, not that bad.
That's a hot game,
yeah, apparently. But no, it's like I've got my copy. I haven't even really broken the shrink on the cards because the sleeves are still incoming. Uh-huh. And so I've really wanted to play it, but I'm like, I can't hold on much longer. Dan, if you hear this,
get him the sleeve.
Send sleeves
now. I'm going to probably have to get some too, because I mean, I've had my copy since, you know, when the first printing first came out. And because whenever I take it to a game night, mine's like the only copy. It always gets played. And so the cards are already starting to be a little bit. So at this point, would it be even worth it? Probably would still be worth it.
Yeah, I still wouldn't. Yeah,
there's a couple that are a little bit frayed on the edges there. But
I have to say, I thought I'd waited long enough to where I was getting the second printing, because I've seen the insert for the second printing.
Oh, okay.
And it's like so much better.
Yeah.
Man, that I got the first printing, it turns out. But that insert is beyond worthless. For Seven Wonders?
Yeah.
It's awful.
Well, it's also, the game doesn't need to have a box that big. You could have it in a box, just a tiny box. Cause
I've almost considered maybe going to a smaller one. I don't really like to do that a lot, but
Like cut the box top off of it and paste it onto the other box?
Yeah, I mean, it looks ugly, but it's like, because the biggest item in the game are the Wonder Boards. Yeah, so I don't know.
So you had a lot of fun playing that one. And
that game also featured Mr. Jeremy D. Salinas deciding that he did not want to do the mannequin piece or the mannequin piss, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, mannequin piss.
Yeah, you can't just trade it out like that. That was the huge faux pas. He's just like, I'm not playing with this one. I'm like, what?
At page 47 of the Seven Wonders Book of Etiquette states,
there are rules, sir, promo or not.
Whatever wonder you are handed, you will play.
So I don't care if you're an HD or not. That'd be a warning.
Okay. Yeah. There'll be a video now from Jeremy. You never see Jeremy's face on camera. It'll be him sitting there just ripping on you about 7-1.
He's just going to slash my tires. It's cool. Okay. I love you, Jeremy.
All right. He doesn't listen to our show.
No.
All right. The other thing that I did the next week at the Game On Game Night is I played Colosseum with a group of five people. And listener and friend Scott Moore brought his copy, and he had just gotten it, I guess, and so it was unpunched, and so we had a little punch party to get the game out of there. And
a punch party
yeah. And then we played, and I remember the rules just well enough to be dangerous. And so it was a little bit of a sort of pseudo-learning game. But it was one of the best experiences. I told Cody this earlier, that it was one of the best gaming experiences that I had in a long time, because it's so fun to get five guys together that, you know, are patient, you know, and are willing to deal with someone who doesn't know the rules quite well, and they don't get irritated when you've got to look something up. And, you know, we just had a great time, and we were making fun of, you know, in this game, you're putting on different kinds of events in Roman Colosseums. And Greg had like this one called the Race of Janus, mm-hmm. that he kept putting on over and over again. Rather than buying bigger events, he just kept putting on the Race of Janus.
The Race of Janus is hot, man. I mean,
that's what we kept saying, is that, you know,
I saw it off Broadway.
He's moving the little emperor token around, and it ends up back in his he passed it, and then it ends up back in his Colosseum, and you were getting this picture of like Nero with his popcorn walking back in going, wait a minute, this is Race of Janus again. I've seen this.
Death Race of Janus.
Exactly. So that was a lot of fun. So had a great time. I was in like first or second place almost the entire game. Last turn, last place.
Ooh.
Oh man, it was terrible.
Yeah, not great.
Yeah, surged ahead. Eric surged ahead. He was the winner of that one. So had a good time with that. We also played Cash and Guns. In the church basement there, yeah.
Very good.
Which was a lot of fun. And, you know, Sean did a good job teaching that one. Pastor Sean.
Those Methodists, they get crazy on you.
I know. So we were having a lot of fun with that one, because, you know, you're holding the guns up. And every time a round would start, I would just say, all right, be cool, guys. Just be cool, all right?
Cool, guys.
We don't have to. It's just be cool. And then we point the guns at each other. So
I need to pick that one up. That's such a fun
one. It's a lot of fun.
Now, the Cash and Guns Live, not the best idea.
Yeah,
you can only really play that like at a con.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like go to the library and, all right, we're going to do Cash and Guns Live.
Yeah. Oh, you know, just briefly, because I'm not sure we've even mentioned that game on the show before. So Cash and Guns, the idea is that you're
I think we have.
Have we?
I think so.
We've done a lot of
episodes. But you can talk about it.
No, it's cool. I mean, you have these foam guns, and it's like you're in the warehouse after you've done some sort of a heist or something.
Oh, you're talking just regular Cash and Guns.
Yeah, regular
Cash and Guns. Oh, but by all means.
Yeah. And you're trying to divide up the money, which is on these little cardboard tokens. And so you put money out, and then you basically hold your gun, and everybody counts to three, and you point your gun at somebody. And, prior to that, you will have put a card face down. And the cards either say click, or they say bang, or they say bang, bang, bang. And so, you know, if it's click, then your gun doesn't go off. It was a bluff. If it's bang, then it fires. If it's bang, 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 then it's almost like first strike in Magic where, you know, your stuff would deal damage first. And so you point the guns, and then after you point the guns, you see how many guns are pointing at you, and you have an opportunity to duck under the table and basically hide, in which case you receive a shame token, but you don't get any wounds. You won't actually get shot. So if you're under the table, or if you're, you know, shot, then you don't get any of the money. Then the money's divided up, and the round game continues until you get to the end of the money. So it's a lot of fun, especially if you got, you know, folks that are that have seen a lot of those movies like Reservoir Dogs, you know. Yeah. But yeah, Cody, you say like Cash and Gungs Live is just a card game where you go out like into the community. I think they encourage you to go out into like public places and play this where, you know, it's all silent and no one's like holding any actual guns. And so you're doing all this kind of weird stuff. Like you can have like a shotgun, in which case if someone shoots you with a shotgun, you have to, you know, put your arms out and then take two big steps back. And anybody that you touch is also hit. And, you know,
play that in an airport. That'd be fun.
No. There's a couple of actually really good videos on YouTube of people playing this in public places. Really? Which is, in French, which is it makes even more fun. So,
the guns.
Yeah. So, anyway, so I had fun playing Cash and Guns. Outside of the game on game night, you and I played a couple things. We played Power Grid, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. Yep. And we played this really cool racing game called Rallyman.
Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit about Rallyman? I know it's my turn, but can you speak a little bit about Rallyman?
Yeah. I had a chance to play with my buddies Greg and Dave, both friends of the show. And David's a big racing game fan. Like, he likes Formula D, and he likes like Daytona 500. And he brought over this one, which isn't available in the U.S. It doesn't have a distributor, but it's called Rallyman.fr. Yeah, on the box, it's like Rallyman.fr. But he got it over, and it basically simulates kind of like rally racing, which I don't know a lot about it, but it's essentially like taking like, I'm going to probably sound completely wrong here, but you take things like Subarus or whatever and soup them up. And
yeah,
you
little cars.
Yeah, do little time trials, right? And so the game, it for me, it kind of plays a lot like Formula D, but the catch is it's not a race. It's not the first one across the finish line. It's all time trial.
Yeah.
And it seems like it would be boring. You're like, oh, if you're just racing the clock. But this game, it's all about, it's got a lot of push your luck mechanics, and it's all about kind of like what gear you end a turn in. It's like if you end your turn in fifth gear, then you only get 10 seconds onto your time, whereas you end in first gear, you get 50 seconds onto your time.
Yeah.
You know, if you run into obstacles, you may spin out, and you have to waste a minute getting back on the road. You know, that's a really kind of top-level view of it. But
like the turns that you go into will tell you have to be in a particular gear to get through them. And so you have to manage when do you want to stop so that you can be in the right gear at that time. It's a lot of fun. I mean, a lot of risk management.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a lot of good fun, and it's got a lot of immersion in it where, you know, you have to give your, you know, each time you play, you have to give it a rally name.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we had the rally to Avon when we played at the game night. But it's just a really neat game, and it's a neat takeoff for racing games because you don't see kind of this time trial sort of thing. Usually it's just, you know, first one across the line wins. So this was a lot of fun, and you know, Dave just got back from his honeymoon, but while he was on his honeymoon, he lent the game to me, and John and I played it, and I really liked it. I'd give this one another play, definitely.
Yeah, it was good enough that I was looking online to see where you might be able to pick it up, and you know, Cody's right. I don't think you can find it. I haven't found it at any retailer here in the States.
Yeah, I hope it picks up a distributor soon, because I think this one's got a lot of potential.
Yeah, definitely. And it's been around for a couple of years. I think it's like 2009, so I don't think it's like a brand new game. But yeah, if you like a game like Formula D, this one's check this one out. It's a lot of fun. So, and then the last thing I played with my my two dear little children is the new D&D board game Wrath of Ashardalon, which I'd played with Cody before.
Excellent pronunciation on the dragon name.
Thank you. Yeah, but there's a myriad of pronunciations all around podcasting as to how that's pronounced. It's Ashardalon. Anyway, so that game is a lot of fun. Of course, if you like Castle Ravenloft, you're going to like this one. If you don't like Castle Ravenloft, this is probably not different enough to make it any better for you. My kids really like to play this game for about 45 minutes maximum.
That's good, though. I mean, your kids are, what, 8 and 5?
8 and 5, yeah.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, they just got a little bored after a while, but which is fine. But, you know, it's still a really good game to play with kids because, you know, they, you can help them to make decisions about what they want to do. You can read cards for them if they need to, but it really creates that sort of dungeon crawl fun experience. So just enjoyed that one. Got that one on GameShare from Myriad Games, and I think that I might keep that one.
So, pull the trigger on it?
Yeah. Dan, if you're listening to this, don't ring me up.
Oh, he's already processed. He's already sold you the next one. Legend of Dritz, done.
He's a wizard, that
you Dan. Need sleeves for all those? I got them.
I got them. So that's pretty much all that I've been playing. Cody, what about you?
It's been a pretty lean few weeks, honestly. I did get a chance to play Merchants and Marauders again. This one was interesting because I didn't really see the Merchant Runaway win. The people that were playing there that knew the game, we all kind of helped to prevent that, because if one person was going Merchant and starting to run away, then we all kind of started to go after him. Yeah, so it was interesting, and I found that, you know, I guess what I'm reading is true, that, you know, it's that hybrid strategy where, you know, maybe you start Merchant, go Pirate at the right time, maybe get something like Pardons or Clemency to clean your slate again, and then jump back into piracy just enough to win. It was good. It seemed more like an advanced game. It's like, now I've played it a few times, and I'm starting to see some deeper strategies come of it. I have that on GameShare for Myriad Games. I'm going to see how well it works as a two-player. My one worry is that it might not be a lot of interaction. Like, if we're just kind of hanging out on our sides of the boards and just merchanting, I think it would just be like a pretty bad Euro game. But
I've heard good things about the two-player game.
Yeah, I'm going to have to try it. We'll see if Kalen likes it. But I played that. Let's see. I played Rallyman, and in that same day, we played another racing game. My sentimental favorite, The Great Space Race, produced by Kinzer & Company, the folks that do the Knights of the Dinner Table comic. And while I've mentioned that, I'd like to give a shout-out to Jolly Blackburn. Him and his wife recently lost their daughter. And if you go on BGG, there's been a big kind of a charity auction, kind of because this is a really unexpected death for them. So hearts go out to them. Jolly Blackburn is the guy who created Knights of the Dinner Table. And
it's a great name.
Isn't it?
Jolly Blackburn?
I believe that's his real name. Yeah,
that's a great name.
And when where else is Muncie, Indiana, the setting for a comic?
Oh, that's where the comic is set. Yeah. Muncie, idea.
Indiana. Yep.
No wonder you like it. I was wondering. Cody has like 1,000 issues of this thing. I was wondering why, but it's the Indiana connection, isn't it?
I don't know. I started reading this. You know, you know how much I'm a nut for nostalgia, and you know. And I started reading this not long after I got into gaming in the beginning. So when Knights of the Dinner Table produces its last issue, there might be some real man tears that get cried. But anyway, back to Great Space Race. This is one of the few board games they've kind of produced, and we've talked about on the show. It's a lot like kind of like Formula D meets Mario Kart, but in space. So you all have these spaceships, and you can drop mines and shoot weapons, and you either have to be the person who crosses the finish line first after three laps, or be the last one standing. Right. So I taught this to Greg and Dave. It can be kind of a long game, so we only did a two-lap race. But I hadn't got this out in a while, and it's such a fun game. It's just a lot of fun. The components are, it's like the card quality especially is pretty terrible. But it's just a really fun game and something that needs to get out more. I don't know how easy it is to get a copy these days, but if you can, it's definitely worth trying out. I don't think it's like a grail game necessarily, but I just don't think it's being printed anymore.
Yeah.
But check it out. Great Space Race. Is there anything else I've been playing? Cause it's been pretty lean.
It's been kind of a lean couple of weeks.
Yeah. I think that might be it. I'm getting ready to start my second 4th edition campaign.
Oh, okay.
Which, speaking of that, I'll go ahead and mention this now. Both myself and Russ Wakeland from the D6 Generation podcast got invites to the beta for the D&D virtual table. This is kind of this online program so people can play D&D over the internet. This was a feature that was promised way back with the launch of 4E, and they're kind of just now getting to it.
Technology.
Indeed. But, it was just Russ and I kind of DM'd just this little kind of one-shot form, lone wolfing.
Did some lone wolfing with Russ?
A little bit.
Scandalous.
Yeah. But, so we did that. For a beta, I was really impressed. Like, I could see where, it's like, I don't really have a use for it because, you know, I have like a weekly, bi-weekly group, you know, I don't really need to play over the internet, but
Yeah, it's because you have friends.
It was my upper echelon of gaming. But for people who either can't find a D&D game, or their old gaming group is kind of just split off and is living in different places,
or you hate them,
or you hate them. you don't like them messing up your house. This is a great option. It you have to have the D&D Insider subscription, but it kind of it's really worth it because you can import all your characters from the character builder. You can import monsters. So, the one thing with a lot of these kind of online tabletop programs is you have to put in everything manually. It's like, if I'm going to have a kobold in there, I have to enter all of the kobold stats and powers, and you have to do that for every monster and every hero, and it just gets tiresome. This, you can bring it in from the wizard's database, so it's pretty slick.
So what about the is it audio? Is it video? How do you communicate with the other people?
It has audio capabilities. I believe it's planning to have video capabilities as well. You can chat, but the main kind of board is you can do like just a battle mat to where you can draw on it, or they have all of the wizard's dungeon tiles. You can just kind of place the tiles and you can place the characters and say, here you are. And it's really slick. So I would definitely check it out if you have a D&D Insider subscription. I think you can still attempt to get in on the beta. But that really increases the value of the D&D Insider. That's a game changer in my opinion. So,
and how much is that subscription to D&D Insider?
It depends. If you get it monthly, I think it's like $10 a month. If you get it yearly, I think it's like $70 for a year. Obviously the year subscription is the best, but depending on your needs, they have multiple ways of retail enlightenment to get to buy it. But that's all I've been doing. Have you been doing any other things?
I've been painting.
Yeah, I've been painting as well.
Because we just got our Dystopian Wars starter boxes, mine for the glorious Prussians. Mm-hmm. And so I've been painting like a fool the last 3 or 4 days. And, the starter box comes with a battleship, 3 cruisers, 9 frigates, 2 bombers, there's airplanes, and then the little 10 little tokens for the tiny airplanes. And so I have painted just in the last few days everything except for the 2 bombers. And so what I found is, and I think it's because these ships are kind of more metallic, which means you can do a lot of dry brushing, I was able to knock out all of the frigates in like less than 2 hours.
Oh yeah.
And I painted the whole battleship in like an hour. So I'm loving that because I don't mind doing detailed miniatures and people and that kind of stuff, but I don't get a whole lot of joy out of just taking hours and hours to perfect something, especially when I don't have that steady of a hand. So I feel like you get really good reward for your time from these models. The resin is very cool. The detail, it's been talked about on other media that the detail on these miniatures is just crazy good. And so I've just really been enjoying it. So got those together, and we're going to be playing our first game sometime soon.
Yeah, I'm kind of behind. I had painted up my battleship in 3 of the cruisers, and then I fell into a bad habit because I'm actually stripping all of my Kador army right now.
Mm-hmm.
And because that was what I painted right when I was getting back into painting, and I looked at it now, and I didn't like the colors, and I just wasn't real pleased with the quality, so I'm just going to go back and do all that. It's cheaper than buying another army.
That's true.
And I was deciding, because I went with a Kingdom of Britannia, and I decided I was going to go with like a Scottish theme. Big Scottish guy, love the Scott stuff. But I was finding that the blue I was using, like, it just kind of blended in with the water board that I made.
So you just couldn't see the models that much?
Well, I could see them. They just didn't really pop as much as I wanted. And the other thing was the land troops. It's like, I think like the command tank for the Brits is like St. Paul's Cathedral, like the dome of it, which is very, which is not Scottish at all. It's very English. And then, with the land troops, you think redcoats, you think, the British.
Right.
So I went with kind of a scarlet. I didn't go like bright British red. I went with a little dark, like a scarlet, and with gold. And I've just done the frigates right now, but I think it's looking pretty good. So
yeah,
I'm going to finish those up and get to plan.
Yeah. So we're both looking through the rules to try to get those down. As we've said before, when we did our War Machine stuff, we're not real... We're not hardcore miniatures gamers, so some folks can sort of sit who've been doing this for years can sit down and just absorb the rules and be like, yeah, I'm ready to go. It's going to take us a little bit more time, but from what I've read so far, I think it's going to be pretty cool. It's going to be a little definitely different from War Machines.
Yeah.
So go with us on this journey, listeners.
That's right.
Other things I've been doing is, well, as far as like reading, as far as things I do in my spare time, you know, I do a little bit of reading. I don't watch TV and movies like everybody else, but I've been reading the Dresden Files series. And so I just wanted to mention that if you've never read that series of books, I'd highly recommend it. I'm on the seventh book in the series, which is called Deadbeat. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely a series of books where you read the first one, and I thought the first one was really not very good at all.
No.
But I liked the character. I mean, Harry Dresden is a wizard who like lives in an urban environment, like in downtown Chicago, and he's like a professional wizard who's in the phone book. So it's like it's got elements of sort of murder mystery plus all the supernatural stuff from demons and wizards and fairies and that kind of stuff. But it's set in this sort of, you know, just normal, you know, real time modern setting.
It's almost got like a film noir kind of feel from what I've read of it.
Yeah,
I haven't read much.
Yeah, but it does. And the more that you read, then the more that Jim Butcher, the author, develops the character of Harry Dresden, the better it gets. And, you know, they start to unfold more and more things about his life and his past. And, you know, just it's just sort of a gains momentum. So we'll see. I think there's like 13 or 14 books in the series. So I'm only about halfway through, but really enjoying those. I've got those on my Nook.
Yeah.
And enjoying that. So, yeah, I've been reading that quite a bit lately. That's been eating up most of my time. So what about you?
I've been reading as well on my Far Superior Kindle. And
no.
Yes. And I'm kind of late to the geek bandwagon on this one, but this Game of Thrones book, huh?
Ah.
Pretty good. I guess I felt kind of burned. I read like the first half of the first Wheel of Time book, and I just hated it. And I just don't see how people enjoy that. You know, I know for some people it's fine, but it was just boring, and I just thought it was not written well. And you know, he died before the whole thing was over, so I felt kind of burned. I'm like, I don't know. I've seen pictures of George R. R. Martin. I don't know if he's going to like make it, you know, to the end of that. I'm sorry.
Terrible.
Sorry. I'm just saying.
Wow.
I decided, you know, I'm going to read this first one. You know, give it a go. And it is. It's one of the best books I've read in years. I mean, it's deep. It's epic. But everything's still tied together, and the thing moves. I don't feel like I'm just, you know, dragging this story along. What finally turned me off of Wheel of Time was when someone's like, oh, the story's pretty good. There's a few slow books in the middle, but then it picks up. I'm like, slow books? Like 1,000-page, 1,500-page books? No, I'm fine. So this is great. And plus there's, you know, games based on it. So
yeah, and the TV show starts up in a week. So
that's, yeah, I'm going to have to come over to your house because I'm not buying HBO.
Yeah, that's. I'm not sure how much longer I have HBO because I got it as part of like my deal with Comcast. So, we'll hold on as long as I can.
Yeah.
But, hey, way to jump on that bandwagon about, you know, 6 years
exactly.
late.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm kind of like that guy in the 80s who's like, hey, Star Wars, right? Yeah,
that's
pretty
that's
good.
Pretty cool stuff.
Yeah,
there, yeah.
Lightsabers and Jedi. That's neat.
All right, well, I think that wraps up what we've been doing. What do you think?
All right. Good by me. Have you heard of this Facebook thing? It's like you can connect with people?
I hear it's pretty cool. All right, let's do the Game On Inbox. Got lots of great emails from you, the listeners. First one here from Jay. Jay says, hi, Jay.
Hi, Jay.
Says, hi, guys. A great episode as always. A couple comments for you. It seems the future is now.
Oh, my.
A Few Acres of Snow, Martin Wallace's next release, appears to take deck building and turn it into a legit board game complete with map. And he gives a link to a geek list.
Few Acres of Snow, just a comment on that. That's like a deck building / war game.
Yeah.
And it touches on the French and Indian War, or the Seven Years War, depending on what side of the pond you are. That's kind of an untapped resource right there.
Yeah.
You know, there needs to be I think they need to delve into like more obscure military conflicts.
Grenada,
yeah,
building on Grenada,
the Spanish-American War. There's not a lot of call for it, but French and Indian War, okay by me.
Yeah, and we know a lot about Martin Wallace now, since we know that he designed Rudenbound.
He did
as well as many other great Euro games.
I heard that somewhere.
Mm-hmm. So that's exciting, and you know, that's
and what a great name, A Few Acres of Snow. That's one of those names you're like, huh. Wonder what that's about.
Must be the French and Indian War.
Of course.
Yeah.
It's Canada. See?
So thanks for that information, Jay, about that one. We'll be looking forward to that one. And he also says, your gushing comments about the survive components. Really?
Oh.
The wooden component designs, while fantastic, were poorly executed, he says. The wood is so light, it feels like the pieces were made from balsa wood. The meeples were of ununiform shape, causing issues for hardcore Survive fans, I suppose. Hardcore Survive fans?
I was going to say, is there anyone that's like, I'm going to play Survive like six times in a row, you know?
It's like the people that play Strat-O-Matic baseball with the actual three-dimensional stadiums.
Yeah,
you know?
There you go.
Maybe it's like that.
It's like, it's a fine game. Are there really hardcore Survive? There must be.
There's hardcore everything.
Jay knows better than we do. Yeah.
And many mountain tiles missed their cut, which meant a nice slice of white down one side of the hex. Also a dead giveaway for people who play this very often. Stronghold has not denied this, and to their credit have replaced all that have requested fixes. Their expansion pack even includes new mountain tiles and new plastic meeples. Kevin Nesbitt reported about an 8% error rate amongst the games, and that's just the people who know to complain. I think you missed the boat on this part of the review, though Survive is a great game.
Missed the boat?
Yeah, I see what he did there. okay, well, I mean, my copy of Survive is...
It's all about you.
Is it, well, that's, you know, it's in great shape.
Okay.
So, you know, that's all I had to go on there. So I didn't even know about these issues with the components, but.
Okay.
All right.
Well, so, thanks for the email, Jay.
Yeah, thanks, Jay.
We have an email from Jeremy Owens from Rochester, New York. And he says, hi, Cody and John.
Hi.
Hi. He says, personally, I thoroughly enjoy deck building and think the two games you pointed out is the worthy heirs to Dominion's Throne are two excellent games. I love Puzzle Strike. I think it achieves its goal by embracing the Dominion model. Instead of trying to change things up by adding elements, a la Thunderstone, Graxia, etc. Thank you. It basically uses the Dominion mechanic straight out, but with a different framework. It could be my love of drop puzzle games that left to my love of Puzzle Strike, but it was done well.
I didn't even think about that being a category of games, but the drop puzzle game. There's a lot
it's,
of the,
it's a new Jones
like Dr. Mario.
I am also enjoying Nightfall. It changed a lot from the Dominion model, but it works as a cohesive unit, in my opinion. There's a more of a learning curve than Dominion, but once the mechanics are grasped, the game has a great rhythm. I doubt this is the best analogy for everyone, but to me, it's Cosmic Encounter with a deck building replacing the Destiny deck.
Ooh. Okay.
Let's think about that one for a while.
Yeah, that was kind of deep.
He basically goes on to say that he doesn't think there's going to be this deck building messiah coming, but he kind of gives two examples of what he thinks like the next great deck building game is going to be. The first one is an economic / trading game where the more a good is purchased, the more merchants with... Oh, sorry, I fell asleep. with that good come to that town for trading. Deck building, dissimulate, increased demand. That, come on, that sounds... Trading?
That was not a comment on your email, Jeremy. It was a comment on...
Yeah, sorry.
Your mechanics.
No, Jeremy, you're cool. Just, yeah. Come on, that's trading in the mid. Yeah, so basically that. And then the other one was a central deck that is built in a game could be combined with a worker placement. Really? A worker placement game to simulate both time passing for tasks and the leveling up improvement of skill. Oh, okay, his next line. Both examples are a bit Euro-slanted, sorry, Cody, and very simplistic, but I'm not a game designer. Regardless, I love deck building games. Against the Jones Theory, I own Dominion, Puzzle Strike, and Nightfall.
Against the Jones Theory, I also own all three of those games.
Well... Sorry. And I'm enjoying the quality ones that have come out. Thanks, Jeremy. And no, I wasn't knocking your email, but I think he's got a point. I think you've definitely seen this kind of Ameritrash bend with deck building games.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, he brings up good points there. It's like, what if you did it as a worker placement game or like a trading in the med game sort of thing?
Yeah.
There could be something there. Not something I want, but.
Well, if you think about it, though, I mean, if you're going to credit Donald Vaccarino with
Donald X Vaccarino.
Donald X Vaccarino as the inventor of the deck building game, you know, he's an American inventor or American designer. And so it is.
Is he?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't think he was.
I'm pretty sure he is.
I didn't know where it was from.
But. Yeah. So, you know, I think that makes it sort of, you know, an American mechanic then, maybe. It's not a Euro mechanic.
Maybe.
I'm saying.
It transcends borders.
Well, I'm just saying that might be why why you've seen more American-style games picking up on this rather than the Euro-style games. Maybe, you know.
Maybe.
So
I don't know. But thank you for the email, Jerry. It made me really think about the fact that it doesn't always have to be, you know, high fantasy or fantasy in general that
right.
You know, we could take this Euro route. So things right. to think about.
Yeah, very good. Next email is from James Hayward. It says, hi, Cody and John.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi.
Loving the podcast and a regular listener. I even phoned in when your line first opened to suggest that you play World in Flames. Still waiting on that review.
Oh, it's on the list.
It's on there somewhere. Yeah, I just need to get a free week in my my life
to set it up.
To set it up and play. Yeah. Anyway, I was thinking about the Extra Life charity and the 24-hour game marathon. I would like to arrange a gameplay marathon for this year. Problem is, I'm based in the Netherlands, and I see this as a U.S.-based charity for U.S. hospitals. Do you know of a way for non-U.S. groups to get involved with Extra Life and donate to our local hospitals? Keep up the good work.
I would say you could take one of two options. I think the first option, and kind of the one, the lesser one in my opinion, you could contact Extra Life, the company itself, and kind of arrange something there. Or you could take the cool option and do like a grassroots thing, right? And, you know, contact a local hospital in the Netherlands, Hup Holland, as it were.
Yeah, yeah.
And
the only European country I've ever been to.
Really? You've got like a Hup Holland scarf, don't you?
I do. I have the orange the Hup Holland scarf, yeah.
Orange. Mm-hmm. But I would contact the hospital directly and, you know, maybe get, if you have a friendly professional game store in your area that, you know, you think would help as well, really get some steam going there. And I think you would almost get more of a response from the ground up, you know, if you know, you could contact the organization Extra Life, but I think if you start on your own and then maybe go to them, you might find better success. But this is something, you know, I don't think a hospital is going to turn you down, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, we'd like to give you money.
Yeah. We don't want that.
No, thank you.
I think the only thing you might run into that, the only benefit you have with having some kind of organization is, I know in the United States here, you know, most charitable donations are tax deductible, so the income tax isn't applied to those donations. So you kind of need to pay into an organization in order to have that kind of benefit. So I'm not sure how that works in the Netherlands if you've got the similar sort of a deal there. But yeah, like Cody says, the hospital is not going to turn down your money, so it would be a really cool thing to pull something together just on your own.
Yeah, but definitely keep us posted. I'd like to see how that pans out.
Yeah, I got Extra Life coming up again in October. I think it's October the 15th, and Cody and I are still trying to figure out what we're going to do for that. We may do something here locally. I don't know. I might go back to New Hampshire. I'm not even sure, yeah, but we'll see what happens. But yeah, you know,
we'll go to Holland. Yeah,
well, that'd be exciting. Yeah,
you're paying.
Okay.
All right, we're going to close out the inbox with an email from David from Clever Mojo Games.
Hello, David.
The makers of Alien Frontiers. It's a game we were so-so on.
We were kind of middle of the road, yeah. Take it or leave it.
No, we loved it.
Yeah.
He says, I'm listening to your newest podcast and enthralled with your deck building commentary. Enthralled?
Really? That's the first enthralling that I think we've ever gotten.
Imagine my surprise to hear that your dream game would be a board game with a deck building mechanic. Our new game in development, Princes of the Dragon Throne, is moving in that exact direction.
Ooh.
I know. We started off planning in a more traditional deck builder, but realized that it had nothing that would set us apart. In the last 2 weeks, we've moved in a whole new direction.
Ooh.
So good
this
for
is
you.
Some scoop here. I like it.
In the news. Princes of the Dragon Throne is developing into an area control and resource management board game that uses deck building as a driver for the other game elements. Players are dragon princes, see, not just a clever name, struggling to control the six realms of Luin and earn enough power to control the entire kingdom. They recruit humans, elves, dwarves, and trolls as support for their dragon army and use the dragons to control the realms and gain bonuses and influence. There will be player interaction from dragon skirmishes over contested realms and deck-building screwage to taunt your opponents. We're really hoping that this is something special both in gameplay and game art. He has sent a few art pieces, and they look really good. Impressive stuff coming out of the gate. And you can go to the BGG page, and it says that reflects their original theme and game elements, but they're going to do some more kind of playtesting and game crunching and put some new information out there. So he says, keep your fingers crossed. You might get your dream game sooner than you thought.
Ooh.
I'm intrigued.
So, you know, I think we were on the right track when we were talking about that. I hadn't heard about any of these games. And now this idea of deck building built into board games is kind of coming through. We're visionaries.
If it's as good as Alien Frontiers, then you know, I'll order a dozen.
Yeah. Snatch it up.
Very good. Well, what do you say we flip the switch and turn on this power grid?
Let's do it.
It's time for another installment in our second look series, but it may be the first look for you, the listener. We're going to be talking about Power Grid.
Isn't the name of this segment, shouldn't it be like Games Cody Used to Hate? That seems to be what this really is.
Well, I may still hate it. You know, you don't know. We haven't listened to the end, but yeah. Games Cody hated and is willing to give another shot, but may still hate.
Yeah.
It's Power Grid.
It's also called Throwing John a Bone. That's pretty much right.
Yes.
All right, yeah. As long as we understand each other.
We can't play Fantasy Flight every week. So we're going over Power Grid from Friedemann Fries.
Yeah.
What company is Power Grid produced by?
In the United States, it's by Rio Grande Games.
Rio Grande Games. Excellent. Mm-hmm. And what's best about this game, aside from any gameplay thing, is the name of the game in German.
Funkenschlag.
Mm-hmm. So there you go.
There you go. Yeah. So Power Grid came out in 2000 and something or other. You know, it's one of those times when
we are podcasting professionals.
I don't have the game box in front of me. I forgot to bring it with me tonight to podcasting. So my apologies.
You have one job.
I have many jobs, sir. But Power Grid is consistently, as Cody mentioned before, near the top of the list of board games that have come out in the last 10 years. And it's a very, I would say the mechanics of the game are pretty simple. But the strategy of it, I think, has some complexity to it that makes people come back again and again to this game. So the theme of the game is that you are trying to build a network of cities that are connected by different power sources and power plants and things like that. And you're creating this network and using resources to fuel your power plants, which are then going to light up the cities and power your cities. As each game turn happens, you're going to be able to use those powering up the cities to gain money, which will then feed your engine to purchase better power plants, get more resources, be more efficient, and then build even more cities, with the goal being at the end of the game that you're going to try to power up as many cities as possible when a particular end condition happens.
Yeah, and I think it's worth repeating that victory condition, because in a lot of games it's just a victory point race or a build X building structures, items, whatever. In this, it's pretty much you are playing for the last turn, and we'll probably talk about this later on. But
yeah, the game ends when the 17th city is built.
Right. Well, that's when the game ends. But then the victory condition.
Right. The victory condition is then that once that happens, it's whoever can power up the most cities.
Mm-hmm.
So you may only be able to power up 12. Maybe you built 17, but if you power up 12 and your opponents can only power up 10, you still win.
Right.
So it's more about what you're able to power up than what you're able to build.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of tension in. You can tell everyone is deciding when they want to make their move, and kind of gauging their capacity and the capacity of the other player. So in a lot of ways, you're playing for that last turn.
Right. And so here's how the turn is sort of structured. You start off with this board. The original game has a double-sided board with either Germany or the United States on it. And I've sort of found that the Germany side of the board is a little bit more balanced as far as the distance between the cities. When you turn over to the United States side, when you start getting out into the Rocky Mountains and the West Coast, there's really long distances between cities, and it costs a lot more to connect those together. So
we didn't even touch the West Coast in our game.
No, we played like a three-player game, and we didn't even get there. And the game plays from 2 up to 6, and I would say plays okay with 2, but plays really good with 6.
Plays best with 6.
Yeah, yeah. But the more players you have, I think the better, because there's just a lot more competition for things. So the idea is that at the very beginning, you're going to get a certain amount of money. You get 50 bucks, I think. And then you, you're going to start off by doing an auction for a power plant. So in the game, you're always going to have 8 power plants displayed in front of you. And the power plants have number values that go from 3 all the way up to 50. And they'll just sort of randomly come out of this deck, and you'll keep them in order. And you'll have a current market, which is the top 4, and then a future market, which is the bottom 4, which you'll be able to sort of see what's coming up in the market. So you can plan ahead if you want to. But each of these power plants is going to be able to power a certain number of cities when you feed it certain resources. The resources in this game are coal, oil, garbage, and uranium.
Mm.
And so, and then there's also power plants that are sort of wind or renewable energy or whatever that don't require any resources to be able to fuel power a certain number of cities. So those are really good ones to get as well. So you'll start off with an auction for a power plant. Now, in every turn except for the very first one, whoever is in first place, meaning whoever has built the most cities, is going to be the person who will start off the auction. So they'll pick a particular card, and then you have to bid at least dollars, at least as many as the number of the power plant. So if it's the level 5 one, you have to bid at least $5. And then the auction goes around, and people can either raise or pass.
Wait, $5?
Sorry. The currency in this game is the Electro. Mm. Yeah.
Or so, the Space Buck.
That's our generic currency for every game we play is the Space Buck. Yeah. So you have to bid at least that much money. And then it goes around the table, and you can bid things up. And it's not one of those auctions where, you know, even if you put money in, if you don't win, you have to still put the money in. You know, it's if you bid and you don't win, you still take your money back. But whoever wins the auction will take that power plant. And then if it was the person who led, then it'll move on to the next person who will pick another power plant. If it's not that person, then the person who started off will pick again since they didn't win one yet. And you'll just continue on until all the power plants have been... you'll continue on until everybody's had an opportunity to bid on a power plant. Only in the first round are you required to buy one, and then beyond that, then you don't have to buy one if you don't want to. So then you move on to the next step, which is purchasing resources. And the one of the things I love about this game is the market that's on the board. So all of the resources are represented by little wooden pieces for the garbage, the uranium, the oil, and the coal.
The coal threw me off.
Why is that?
Because I think coal, I think black.
Oh, uh-huh.
And so I kept thinking the oil, which is like a black cylinder, like a barrel of oil sort of thing. I kept thinking that was the coal.
Oh, and the coal just is just like brown cubes.
Yeah, see the oil should almost be like... See, I'm getting all fancy flight here. The oil should almost be like silver.
The oil should be a miniature of a dragon.
Yes. No, it should be these highly detailed plastic resin miniatures. No. That's all I got.
Okay. Kevin Wilson Designs Power. And so
then there's fights and swords. Oh, I'm sorry.
The way that the market is built on the board is that you'll have basically all of your resources in a line, and then the market is divided up into chunks so that the things that are at the one end of the line are going to cost less than the ones as you go farther down. So it's very masterful in the way that it's created, in that maybe your first three coal cubes will cost $2 each. Then once those come off the board, then you'll go to the next chunk and see where are the cubes sitting. Well, they're sitting on, you know, now it's $3 per cube for the next three. Then it's $4 per cube for the next three. So as the supply decreases, the price is going to go up. And it's just natural on the board. It's very easy to see. And it also makes it very strategic because all of the resource getting phase starts with the person who's in last place, who has the least number of
the cities. Worst begins.
It says on the card, the worst begins. And then they'll get to pick. And so all of this is open information. Like, you can look across the table and see what kind of power plant someone else has. And so if you have one that's will operate by coal, and you look and see your opponent does too, then that's a strategy you can have, is to sort of hang back, not be in the lead, so you get to buy resources first, and you can buy up a ton of coal to drive the price up on your opponent. So that's kind of a fun part of the game there. And so everybody will buy up their resources in turn, and then you'll have the phase where you're going to build cities. All the cities on the board during the very first part of the game, it costs 10 electro to place a city onto the board, your first city. And then when you want to connect one, you'll pay another 10 to your connecting city, and then the little kind of pipe that runs in between the two cities will have a number on it, and that's the connecting fee. So you'll pay the 10 for the city plus whatever the connecting fee is. And so as the game progresses, eventually you'll reach what's called step 2, which is triggered by a certain event in the game, which is going to allow more than one player to be on a city, except that now if you're the second person on a city, it's going to cost you 15 to be on there. Later on in the game, when you get to step 3, now a third player can be on there for $20. So, you know, you kind of start off the game much like Ticket to Ride. You sort of leave each other alone for a little while, and then you start running into one another, and you start having to pay more and more money in order to build the network that you want to build. And so that's where your choices there kind of go in. Again, this starts off with the worst. The person who's in last place is going to get to build first. So you're going to keep track of, and there's a little chart on the board of who has, how many cities each player has, so that by the end of the turn, it's real easy to determine what the new player order is going to be. After you've built all your cities, then you're going to power up your cities. This is called the bureaucracy phase, but this is where you're going to get paid. There's a chart that says how many cities you're going to power, based on how many cities you're going to power up, how much money you're going to get. So you'll basically then spend the resources by taking them off of your power plants, cards, and putting them back into, you know, a pile on the side of the board. And then you'll be able to get money for that. Then some part of the bureaucracy step is that the highest level power plant that's on the market is going to go on the bottom of the deck. And there's some other little sort of card shuffling and management to keep the game flowing. But then you'll basically repeat this same turn over and over again until you get to the condition where that 17th city is built. And then that's going to trigger the end of the game. And then, you know, whoever is able to power up the most cities at that point is going to be your winner. So that is the basics of how the game is played. The overall mechanics are very simple. You have very simple choices as to what you're going to make. You're buying power plants. You're buying resources to fuel those power plants. You're building cities. And then you are getting money for powering up a certain number of cities. You have a lot of flexibility with all these things because you're never required to, build. You're never required to buy resources. And you're never required to power up anything if you don't want to. But that's going to be what's going to get you money to help drive the game forward for future rounds. Because if you don't have any money, you can't buy any better power plants and so forth. So it's an engine building game in that respect. But I found that the game has a lot of real good tension to it, and a lot of real good strategy as well. So, Cody, we took a second look at Power Grid, and we hadn't played it in a long time. And what is your are your thoughts on this game?
You know, the second look, it's still a Euro, but
to the core,
But I really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. And what's nice about this one is that it's a Euro, but I still think it's somewhat themed like an Ameritrash because, you know, your power, you're getting all these materials and you're powering up kind of your power grid. But like the art direction in this game and even the little meeples, they're not really meeples, but, you know, the little things for the garbage and stuff.
Yeah.
It's close enough to where I make that connection, you know. It's not like everything is cubes.
Yeah.
And the map is just very generic. It has a very kind of almost like an art deco industrial look to it. It's just very odd.
Yeah,
But it's an attractive game, and that draws me in. And then, like with most of the good Euro games, elegant is a word I would use to describe it. It's like, yeah. I can see why this is popular. I can see, you know, especially once you get a big game going, like a 5 or 6 player game going, and especially if they all know the game, like if it's not their first time, you know, this could be a really strategic and really cutthroat bidding game. It's I enjoyed it a lot more this go around, and I kind of hope this is a recurring theme. You know, games Cody used to hate, sort of a thing. But it's neat because it combines, you know, this engine building kind of mechanic and an auction mechanic. I love auction mechanics, and just this kind of quirky theme into a really enjoyable game. Mm-hmm. You know, short of doing a full review, my one real concern with it, and I don't know if this would change with multiple plays, is I don't know if I like the feeling of just playing for the last turn. You know, and you might say, well, isn't that what you're doing normally? You're playing for the last turn, so you're in the lead. I don't know, because it's almost, and this is a very Euro argument to make, but it's almost like you can play a really good game, and then if you're just caught off guard or unprepared when that last turn comes and you're not ready, you could lose.
Yeah.
And you know, I just made the Euro gamer argument.
You did, yeah. Cause, I mean, I see that as just you need to be aware of what's going on. Yeah,
and you do.
And there are a lot of times in the game, I know, and I think I won the game that we played, mm-hmm. but there was a lot of times when I was sitting there with my money and counting it and figuring out what do I want to do this turn, and do I want to buy this now or do I want to wait? And that's kind of the interesting decisions in the game, but it's not real forgiving. I mean, I think, you know, it's more forgiving than a lot of other Euro style games in that by having that catch up mechanic of the turn order, I think it keeps people in the game. Like, I don't think that you're going to end up in a 3 or 4 player game with one, you know, all the players have 12 or 13 cities and then another player has 3.
Right.
You know, because it's
unless they're just like really, really bad at it.
Yeah, because that person who has 3, you know, even if that was the case, for the next X number of rounds, they're going to get the first, they're going to get the last pick of the auction, which basically means that if they don't bid on anything, they're going to get the lowest price on whatever one they choose that's left over, you know. So they're going to always have to get to pay the lowest price. They'll get to buy their resources first, so they get the cheapest prices for those. They'll get to build first, which means they'll get the prime spots for those things too. So it, with all those things in their favor, someone who's in last place very easily is going to be able to catch up and move into a position of contention, which I think is a good thing for these kind of games. You don't want to feel like you're just completely out of it.
And then, right. Yeah, I think the catch-up mechanic in this game, it's a bone of contention with some folks, but I think it's done really well, and it just that's where it avoids kind of what I feel is a common Euro thing, where it's like if you don't have the winning strategy out of the gate, you're just burned. You will never catch up. So, like I said, that aside, the end game aside, which I may repeated plays may make that go away. This is a really good game, you know. And this is kind of the sweet spot for me because this is about. This is about the game length. This is about the brain burn. This is about kind of, I guess, as Euro as I want to get.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to play this all the time, but I could play this regularly, I would say. You know, I don't want to get much more. This makes me sound like an idiot. I don't want to get much more thinky than this, you know.
No, that's understandable.
You know, it's kind of like when we did Wealth of Nations. To me, and you know, maybe we need to give that a second look because that could be apples and oranges, but that seemed really... Like, there was a lot going on, and there's just a lot of brain burn. And this was, like, there was definitely, you know, you had to think, you had to plan things out, you had to budget, but it was stimulating instead of overwhelming. Like, yeah. Oh, this is interesting, you know, if I could do this turn. And,
well, you can plan a little bit, but you can't plan out too far in advance because you don't know what power plants are coming up. And that's a good thing, I think, because... You know, you can't have that overarching strategy and just say this is what I'm planning on doing. Just, you know, press the engine and go. Mm-hmm. You know, you really have to play them as they lay. You know, in certain situations.
Yeah, because if correct me if I'm wrong. So I think like the best power plant in the game, the 51, is where you can power up 7 cities for free.
7 for free. Yeah.
Yeah, but you're not guaranteed.
It's like cold fusion.
you're not guaranteed to see that every game. Is that correct?
No. Yeah, depending on the number of players, you pull a certain number of power plants out of the deck. So it happens even in our 3-player game, that one did show up in our deck. But if that one shows up early in the game, then it's going to go away because at the end of every round, the highest power plant goes to the bottom of the deck.
Right.
So once you get to the third step in the game, then which is triggered by a card that comes out in the deck, then you have 6 power plants on the board and all of them are up for grabs, and the highest one doesn't go to the bottom of the deck. So that's the only time it's going
to
come up.
I was saying more to where you can't just have the strategy, well, I'm just going to not bid on anything except for these 3 when they come up, or I'll just, you know, because they may not come up and you don't know what's taken out. Right.
Yeah, so, and you know, if you have a particular resource that you can't even go in with the strategy of, I'm just going to buy all the uranium stuff up and then that'll be good. Cause someone else might too. And the other thing I didn't mention, I guess, is that at the end of your turn, there's a chart on the back that says how you replenish the market. And the market does not completely replenish every turn. And so only a certain number of coal cubes are going to go back and only a certain number of garbage cans are going to go back onto the board. And so, you know, you may never see coal back down to $2 per cube ever again in the game unless no one buys it. And then it'll eventually replenish. But, you know, so if you want, like, uranium starts off costing like $15, $16 per, you know, rod, and then slowly as the game goes on, the price goes down. But if you have 2 or 3 people that are trying to use uranium, that's going to be real expensive, and you know, and so you can't really go in with just that strategy and expect to win. So I like that because I think I've said this before. I just don't like games where. It's why I don't really like Magic that much competitively. So I don't like games where you just sit down and you know you're going to lose because the guy across from you, you know he's got the better strategy.
Yeah.
I like it to be more even, sitting down of like, you know, I've got a brain. This player also has a brain. Maybe they played more than I have, so they have a little bit of an advantage. But overall, all things being equal, we've got an equal shot at this thing. You know, I really like that about games.
So. Yeah, I think this one scratches all the right itches. It's if more Euros were like this... I think I would like a lot more of them because this just is kind of the perfect storm for me. I really like this game.
Yeah, so this one's kind of a new classic and definitely one that you should check out if you haven't. It's Freedom on Freeze's Power Grid. Accessorize, accessorize with guys, guys, just on, and tell on, and on, accessorize, accessorize with guys, guys.
on the heels of that Power Grid second look, one of the things that, I thought really enhanced our game was that we didn't use the paper money in it.
No.
A while back, I had actually bought on sale a bunch of blank poker chips. And, these are, like, I think, like the 11.5 gram one. They're pretty thick. They got some clink to them. I'd bought like about $100 worth, you know, that would cover about any game I played. Because, you know, I think we'd played like Lords of Vegas. I'm like, this game would be so much better with poker chips.
Yeah. It's criminal that it wasn't included in the game.
Yeah. Well, that would have jumped the cost up a little bit. True. And so, you know, I found other games in my collection that really benefit from it. And for Power Grid, it was great. You know, I just thought it helped it flow. And that got John and I thinking, what kind of gaming accessories are we seeing more and more of? Because I think in like the last few years, I've seen more of, you know, you kind of have the Plano boxes have always been a standby, but you're seeing a lot more of like the kitschy things, you know, like I have the Hold It card organizer, this big fancy card holder.
Mm-hmm, with the label that doesn't come off, right?
With the obnoxious label that doesn't come off. But a lot of people use like business card holders. And, you know, I use a lot of those little kind of like bead organizers to hold chits for games. And we were kind of thinking what, and this is something we really want to engage the listener on, is like, what are our mainstays in your collection that maybe aren't tied to a single game? Like, I have the poker chips, I've got the Hold It thing, but it's just sitting loose in my game closet. You know, I pull them out for whatever game seems necessary. So for you, John, what are some of the things you found that have come in handy?
Well, you know, I don't have a whole lot of them because you have quite a few. And so whatever Cody has, I don't need to have. And so, you know, he's got the cool Hold It organizer. I mean, for me, it's mainly about things like box control. You know, it's like I want to be able to fit everything in the right, you know, location and you know, not have stuff rolling around in the box because I spine all of my games and everything. So, I mean, you know, those Plano boxes are one of the first things that I thought of, which I think is kind of funny because the Plano company, why do they make those boxes? I don't even know why.
It's fishing.
Is it fishing stuff?
Like fishing and hunting and stuff.
Okay, so it's really hilarious to me that, you know, that board gamers, right, I think, have become huge buyers of those things. You know, I hate to have dice rolling off the table. So I have a dice tray that I try to use sometimes.
Which you've got such a nice one from that defunct company, Dwarven Sweatshop.
Dwarven Sweatshop, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
I wanted to get that very next year. I looked for their booth at Gen Con, and like, oh, they're out of business. I'm like,
yeah,
really?
That's a shame. Yeah,
but no one makes those really nice dice trays
anymore. Yeah, it's like a pentagon. I think it's like a pentagon, mm-hmm, or hexagon, something like that. And yeah, with a nice felt bottom to it, you know, kind of a
nice
cherry
wood.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So it's good stuff. So yeah, something to roll the dice into, I think, is an important thing. I think some folks like dice towers. I've never actually owned a dice tower before. Have you?
No.
Yeah. So yeah, but you know, what kind of things do you like? I'm not drawing a blank so much as I just, you
well,
know.
Well, here's a follow up question for you. This is where I was kind of heading with this. Some people kind of, there's a lot of the game boxes, and I mentioned this for Seven Wonders earlier, just don't really seem to match the task at hand. And so I know a lot of people, and I actually tried this for a little bit. I've got a couple empty cases in there where I thought, okay, these especially like card games, like your, think like For Sale or Family Business, you know, they come in that standard kind of small box, but they really could be half that size. So I'm like, would I be willing to put that in a smaller, like one of those plastic photo cases, you know, and would that work? And what I found was, it's like, I could put it in there, but you lose a lot of the shelf appeal. You know, how much, yeah, you know, you just have a bunch of plastic boxes. I even tried putting the bigger games in the big scrapbooking square plastic containers. And I was just like, you know, it works, but it's not pleasing. So what do you do much, I guess, to mitigate bad boxes? Like, how far would you take something like Seven Wonders? Or, you know, here's another example, like Wrath of Ashardalon and Castle Ravenloft. Again, Russ from the D6G, he tweeted to where he did this kind of multi, like, Plano box set. I don't even know if he has kept the original boxes, but he pretty much has everything in the game in two boxes.
Yeah.
You know, it's functional, but does it look as good on the shelf, sort of thing? So what's your line, or do
you
even
care? This is hard.
Care?
This is really hard for me because I, when I get a game box, even when it's an expansion, something about the box, I feel like there's, you know, there's nice artwork on the box usually.
Sometimes.
And so I feel really bad about, you know, just chuck in the box, even when it makes sense. I have all of my Descent stuff basically in just a couple of boxes. I think I kept one of the expansion boxes, like Well of Darkness, and I have a certain set of stuff in there, and I've consolidated everything down to where I think it's in two or three boxes. All of my HeroScape stuff is in a big plastic tub because the box that originally comes in is worthless anyway. But I find it real difficult to consolidate things like that. The card games are, I have a whole, my whole top shelf of my game collection is pretty much card games. And I think the shelf appeal thing is really the hard thing. It's the visibility of it. You know, it's not like I have, when someone comes over to my house to play games, like a menu, you know, well, please select one of these and I'll go and get it for you. You know, it's all about what can you see on the shelf. And so if I've got a game, if I've got a 15 card games that are in a big box, you know, like a baseball card box, yeah, that's good storage, I guess, but I just think they won't get played as often because you won't see that nice and shiny box.
So. Yeah. I mean, that happens. I recently consolidated all of my Dominion into one big baseball card size box. Yeah. And it's so much better, you know, just for playing a game, where especially because I like mixing all the expansions in. But I don't have that box on the shelf anymore, and I just forgot it existed for the longest time. Mm-hmm. And then I was just, you know, like cleaning things. I'm like, oh, I have Dominion here and like four expansions.
I mean, I have like two Yomi decks in my, actually the bag that I put all my sound equipment in when I come over to Cody's to do podcasting. And we haven't played that in a long time. But if I had the Yomi complete first edition box and it was sitting on my shelf, I know I'd play it more just because it'd be, oh, Yomi, yeah, that's a good game, yeah.
It's funny, you mentioned expansions. That's like I don't shed a tear over expansions. Like if the box is worthless, gone. Like even like Seafarers of Catan, I found a way just to put everything into the main box. I chucked it. I'm like, yeah, that's crap. But certain things are I don't know, like Summoner Wars, I have all of my factions in one baseball card box. I just put little dividers in there because, I mean, that was just tricky to deal with. But like Seven Wonders, I don't know if I could do that, even though it would be a better solution. It's like I like that game so much and I want that to kind of stand out. You know, I don't know if I just want to put that in a baseball card box.
That's why companies like Days of Wonder is the best example I can think of that have very purposeful box inserts, you know. I think Cargo Noir recently was probably one of the first that wasn't that way.
Oh, it was terrible.
Yeah, but
I had to check it just because you couldn't get the box closed.
Yeah, but you know, we played Colosseum last week, and it's kind of funny because you punch everything out in that game. It comes with a sheet that tells you where everything goes so that you can make sure to put it all in the right spot. And I really respect that someone takes the time to do that kind of stuff because I hate having to sort of figure it out on my own. And so I see that as being kind of part of the artwork of the game, you know, that someone really took time to create this nice Days of Wonder box insert for Colosseum where it's a place for everything. And so I would feel bad chucking that for any reason. If it came out with three expansions, I would still want to keep that original box because of that, you know?
Yeah. And something that's interesting is I think you're seeing game companies really start to latch on to this, having maybe stock accessories that aren't game specific that you can bring out for things. Fantasy Flight's a good example. They came out with their Fantasy Flight supply line, which originally was just like sleeves, but now they have those little like gaming chits, you know, kind of like the
tokens,
like the gold and citadels, but in different colors. They've got that. They've just come out with these like assorted wooden pieces that, you know, think like Catan. You have like small house, big house, road, you know, wooden circle. They're not game specific, but you can certainly find a use for them.
Yeah.
And you have, you know, like companies that make the things like the Hold It and things like that. So I think you're seeing this push to where, you know, maybe they assume gamers will have a standard suite of organizational tools that they can pull from. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I think a lot of people do this kind of unwittingly. You know, I've kind of got my default thing now. I may add to it. But I guess the question that I would want to pose to the listeners is, what do you have in your kind of generic suite of, gaming accessories? What makes your game better? Is it like a table mat? You know, those people at Boards and Bit make that really cool table mat. I have a 5-foot round table that doesn't really work unless I buy two and cut it. But I would love to own one because I think that would be really neat.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of things. So
like tokens, I think, are good. I mean, you mentioned the Fantasy Flight tokens. I almost think about those even more with like miniatures wargaming. You know, I have a specific set of War Machine tokens for my Menoth army that are the new ones that Privateer Press came out with. Yeah. And they're really useful. And, you know, I could use dice to keep track of focus and all that kind of stuff. But for me, it's a lot more fun to actually have the physical tokens. I feel like it's very customized to my game.
And see, I use the little gray tokens from Fantasy Flight for my focus.
Yeah. And you even in the past have used Ice House or Looney Pyramids for that.
Absolutely.
And it works for that, too. Mm-hmm. So in those games, I think especially where you have to keep track of a lot of different things, and we're noticing in Dystopian Wars, looking through the rules, that you have to keep track of like fuel and action and assault points and everything. So there might be use for some additional accessories there.
Right. So we would encourage you, the listeners, to send us an email.
Oh, at the Game On Inbox at gameoninbox@gmail.com.
So that's a little clunky. call the Game On Hotline.
At 4138 Game On.
And tell us what gaming accessories for you are you couldn't live without or that sit in your library and that are ready to be unleashed on any game.
Yeah, now, give us some. Yeah, give us the ones that we don't even know about that we've got to pick up.
I'm really curious about this.
We want the scoop, all right? We want to know what are the best things.
Yeah. And speaking of gaming accessories, it's a little late in the show, but I feel like I must give our due penance to our friends at Myriad Games, who sponsor Game On with Cody and John on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere, because Myriad Games has probably one of the best lineups of the gaming accessories I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. But most places, you know, will have maybe some tokens here or things of dice here. No, Dan's got you covered with pretty much almost all of the Fantasy Flight supply, if not all of it. He's where I got the Hold It from. I didn't even know it existed until I saw it in Myriad Games. But, you know, special sleeves, all of that. Myriad Games is going to hook you up. So not only do they sell games, they sell some of the great gaming accessories that you can really use to improve your gaming experience.
Let me mention one more thing. Everything that you said was true.
Thank you.
Quoted for truth. Another thing about Myriad that happened to me just in the last couple of weeks that just once again proves what a great friendly professional game store they are is I went to the Game On game night and my friend Sean had said, "Hey, I really have been trying to find a copy of The Resistance and I really want to play that game and I can't find it anywhere. Can't find it anywhere online, can't find any local retailer, just can't find it anywhere." And it was kind of funny that when he said that, I immediately, of course, thought, "Oh, I'll call Dan at Myriad," and it wasn't like I thought, "I'll call Dan at Myriad, and he probably doesn't have it either." It's like I just sort of had this confidence of, "Oh, Dan will have a copy. You know, I'll get him to send you one." And so I emailed Dan that night, you know, and sure enough, you know, within like 15 minutes, he's like, "Oh yeah, we've got a copy of that. You want me to send it to him?" And it was just like that. So it just so happened that I didn't get back to him in a couple of days, and Sean was able to find it from another online place or something like that. So he snatched it up. But I just another good, great example of the confidence that you can have with Myriad of just being able to find stuff in stock. You know?
Their stock is second to none.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I've never had any problems. So check them out at myriadgames.com. Nice, shiny new site. And if you sign up for the MVP membership, you can really see what perks they have.
Indeed.
Indeed. All right, well, we'd like to thank you for listening to another fully accessorized, a power switched on, a fully adequate episode of Game On.
A right down the middle mediocre episode of Game On. Well, thanks so much for listening. As always, we would encourage you to check out our website at gameonpodcast.com, where you can see all kinds of good stuff, including our donation button, where it's always one of the best ways that you can support the show is by hitting that donation button. And
100% of the things go back to you and help produce a better show for your consumption.
Right. So join us in 2 weeks where we've got lots of other great gaming stuff coming to you from Indianapolis, the gaming capital of the world. And until then,
Game On.
This episode of Game On is sponsored by Myriad Games on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere. If you'd like to contact Cody and John, send them an email at gameoninbox@gmail.com. Or leave a voicemail at 413-8-GAME-ON. For more content, check out our website at gameonpodcast.com. Join our guild on boardgamegeek.com and connect with other fans of the show. Become a fan of our show on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Game On Podcast. Game On with Cody and John is a proud member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network. Check out other great shows on pulpgamer.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time, game on.
Well, howdy gamers, is
really? Oh, that was the very first take.
I'm here.
Alrighty.
Alright, well, it's time for the rundown where we tell you, where we tell you all the good stuff we've been doing. Boy, howdy.
Oh my.
I do declare.
Alright, games that I've been playing recently, I've, you know, but
yep.
Yep. All right.
And it begins.
No, you've already got two. That was just one for me. All right, let's do the game on inbox. We're going to open up and... What's that?
Two-two.
Well done. All right, well, let's do the game on inbox. We're going to open up the inbox and read all of your emails. And I'm just going to do this again.
And the lead. All right, we're going...
There's our story. Yep. We're all tied up again.
It's a tie game.